You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today on The Scoop, a North Vancouver exhibit aims to honor the region's transportation past and provide some insight for the future. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby tells us more. And a local bioremediation group in Hazelton, BC is working to find a climate-forward solution to dealing with wood waste. Pam Hassan at CSK News in Smithers tells us how. I'm Dan Messick, and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from North Vancouver, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. In July of this year, the Museum and Archives of North Vancouver, or MANOVA, unveiled its latest feature exhibit, titled, Are We There Yet? The Sustainable Transportation Journey. Found in MANOVA's feature gallery space, the exhibit includes archival material and photographs related to the transportation history of the North Shore, its evolution, and where transportation in the region could be headed. A unique addition to the exhibit is its option for community feedback, which allows those that attend to write down and submit their suggestions for the future of transit on the North Shore. CJSF took a trip down to MANOVA to see the exhibit for ourselves, where we were greeted by the museum's director, Zoe Makoff de Miranda. We sat down for a conversation and learned more about why this exhibit came to fruition.
MANOVA, one of the things that we're really interested in doing with our feature gallery space is thinking about what topics are important to the community here today, what conversations are people having, or, you know, what do we want to create dialogue around? And transportation is definitely a hot topic of conversation. So we wanted to get involved in that conversation and create space for dialogue around the history of transportation and what the future here might look like.
When entering the gallery space, one of the first things we noticed was a series of political cartoons depicting congestion within the North Shore, as well as a newspaper that exclaimed the need for rapid transit in the area. This is an issue that is still being talked about today within the North Shore. When I first saw this cartoon, I thought it was from the 1990s. Thankfully, I was quickly corrected.
So a couple of things. First, I'm actually going to correct you because those drawings are not from the 90s. They're actually from the late 60s and early 70s. Okay. So they're even older than you thought. They are political cartoons from a newspaper that was called the North Shore Citizen, which was the precursor to the North Shore News. They're by an artist named David Olivoyne, and we have a collection of his cartoons in our archives. And they are from the late 60s, early 70s, sort of talking about congestion, the problem with congestion on the North Shore. And I think one of the reasons you thought they were from the 90s is there's one drawing in particular. There's a gentleman sitting in traffic coming down the cut trying to get across the Second Arrows Bridge, the Ironworkers Memorial Bridge, and he's reading a newspaper that says rapid transit North Van to Vancouver by 1990 cost $300 million, and then at the bottom of the comic it says, you know, great news, you know, for $300 million, we only need to put up with this for 20 more years. So that was in 1970 saying, oh, we only have to wait till 1990 to get rapid transit. It's now 2025. And we do have BRT, the bus rapid transit that's coming. We actually have the C bus, which did not yet exist at the time that comic was written. But yeah, certainly, you know, it's interesting to look back and see that congestion actually is not a new problem. It's something that's been happening on the North Shore for a long time, and we really need to, as citizens and municipalities, think about what solutions are in the future.
Dave Miranda and I then discussed the public feedback aspect of this exhibit and some of the ideas the people have been writing for the future of transportation on the North Shore.
When we created that space, I kind of anticipated that we would potentially get a lot of negative feedback, sort of like a almost like an in-person Facebook, if you will, an opportunity for people to complain. And I've actually been really pleasantly surprised. The majority of the comments that we've been getting are really constructive. I think people really have ideas. They live in the community. They know the area. They know the neighborhoods, and they have, you know, ideas about what they'd like to see. So it's been really constructive. I think there's the typical things like, you know, a third crossing, you know, extension of the SkyTrain. There have been some comments about, you know, maybe adding another sea bus route. What if there was a sea bus that went from West Van, you know, where the ferry building gallery is? There used to be sort of a ferry dock there, for the small ferries that went across the inlet. And so the idea of what if we had ferries that went from West Van over to near UBC, for example. There's people that talk about wanting to bring back the streetcars. So it's quite fascinating. I think people really want solutions.
We then discussed how Minova has engaged with local municipalities as well as the Tsleil-Waututh and Squamish Nations for this exhibit.
So we do work really closely with the municipalities. When we were developing the exhibition, I did reach out to the transportation departments and let them know this was a topic that we would be covering. We know that BRT, Bus Rapid Transit, is coming. That's something the municipalities have been very engaged on, and also the local nations as well. There's a group called North Shore Connects, which is the three North Shore municipalities, so North Van City, North Van District, West Vancouver, and the Squamish and Tsleil-Waututh Nations, kind of working together to talk about transportation infrastructure. So, you know, really in terms of the city and district in particular, really it's us providing feedback following the exhibition, and a lot of folks from the municipalities and the nations have been engaged in terms of coming in and sort of seeing what we're talking about through the exhibition.
Later on, we were given a tour of the exhibit and all of its archival materials, including an old bus fare collection box used in the 60s and 70s that makes a different noise depending on the value of coin that you insert.
I'm going to do a quarter first. Okay, that's a quarter. There's a dime. A nickel. And here comes the penny, which, you know, those are hard to find these days, so we didn't actually hear this sound right away at the beginning of the exhibition. We had to track down some pennies.
We were then shown some materials and transportation vehicles that signify the sustainable transportation possibilities on the North Shore.
Yeah, so one of the things when we're talking about sort of sustainable transportation and the future of transportation, there's a lot that's being done at a municipal level and actually through TransLink as well, looking at active transportation. So that's improved walking and biking routes and thinking about different ways for people to move around our city. So we have two bikes here that are from the 1930s and 40s, kind of just showing you know, what the bike technology was at the time. These are from our museum collection. And then next to that, we actually have an e-cargo bike. So this is an electric bike. It has a cargo carrier. This is obviously a pretty big departure from what was available in the 1930s and 1940s. And so this is just sort of to show the evolution in some of that technology of what's available, you know, that makes getting around on a bike a little bit easier for those who are able to ride a bike. And actually, the bike we have is from the e-cargo bike program that's put on through the District of North Vancouver and the City of North Vancouver, where through the Evo app, you can actually rent the e-cargo bikes, which is pretty amazing. So they're available to pick up at some of the local North Vancouver District public libraries. And so again, just looking at different infrastructure that's available to help people move around in a sustainable way.
Lastly, we asked Zoe Makoff de Miranda what she hopes some of the key takeaways are for those who attend this exhibit. Here's what she had to say.
You know, I think one of the takeaways that we'd like people to have is to think about what role they can play towards a more sustainable future of transportation on the North Shore. And I want to say that sustainable means both in terms of the environment, from an environmental perspective, but also sustainable in terms of our growing population. You know, the population is continuing to grow, and, you know, we do have there are a lot of people on the North Shore that do have a car. You know, that's not accessible for everyone, but for people who do have a vehicle, you know, I think it's not a question of saying, you know, get rid of your car and, you know, all cars are bad. It's really just to say, you know, maybe think about your routine and are there small incremental changes you can make that can help contribute to greater sustainability. So maybe is there one day a week that maybe you don't need your car? Is there a certain activity? Maybe can you take the C bus or ride a bike? And if we all sort of consider that and think about small incremental changes, that would overall help us get to a more sustainable place.
Once again, that was our conversation with Zoe Makoff de Miranda, the director of the Museum and Archives of North Vancouver. This exhibit, Are We There Yet? The Sustainable Transportation Journey, is available to be seen by the public until March 1st, 2026. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is CICK News. I drove to Sikadak on Thursday last week to meet Anissa Watson at a community garden. The community of Sikadak is well on its way to becoming food sovereign by raising their own chickens and pigs. They have a food-safe kitchen in the community center, massive gardens for growing seasonal veggies and fruit trees, as well as a recently built greenhouse for off-season growing. We met at the back edge of a farm close to a treed area where we stood in front of 10 piles of wood chips. Within these wood chips were mycelium with the power to change how we in the north manage wood waste. These mycelium have undergone rigorous training to learn to eat these wood chips with the goal for them to eat eventually bad wood, such as creosote-soaked rail ties and slash piles, to minimize burning or waste wood entering our precious river system. Here's Anissa now from Sikadak. Where are we?
So we're in the community of Sikadak. This is a Gitxsan community, probably about 15 kilometers out of Hazelton, BC. We are going down into an area where they're just working to develop some food security sites. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at here in front of us, even though it looks just like a pile of wood chips, is a field testing site for a project called Coldfire.
That's Anissa Watson, the Director of Program Execution for Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition. A local innovation project called Coldfire is using mushrooms to tackle wildfire risks and waste wood management. Partnering through the Fire Grand Challenge, the team is testing how fungi can speed up the natural decay of wood waste, turning it into compost that stores carbon, keeping nutrients in the soil, and promoting healthy regeneration. 10 piles have been created as part of this science-based field trial in the community of Sikadak.
What we did in the early summer is we had our technical partner, Coalitions and Collaboratives, come up from Colorado. Those mushrooms were cultivated off of trees, so wild cultivation. So these mushrooms were trained to eat this specific wood in the lab, and then they were grown. So their next generations of DNA were basically like trained specifically to eat this wood here. So we started off with four different types of mushrooms and then chose the best quality one from the lab experiments to inoculate the piles with.
All summer, the Coldfire team has been hard at work gathering and chipping waste wood for their mushroom-based wildfire prevention project. 3 weeks ago, they inoculated the piles with moist mushroom spawn blocks supplied by Smithereens Mushrooms. Each pile has 9 inoculation points, and already the piles have dropped nearly 2 feet as the fungi get to work breaking down this wood. The team's been back in the field collecting data, measuring pile size, moisture levels, and carbon content to track how well the mushrooms are transforming waste wood into rich, healthy soil, which is where Anissa and I met to have this discussion.
Last week, we harvested a bunch of mushrooms. It looks like I think some other folks were harvesting mushrooms off of here, which is exactly the point.
Yeah.
So we've been getting oyster mushrooms off of all these piles. And what we're looking at is just like, how quick is this happening? How much moisture are they holding? And then in about 3 years, we're expecting these piles to be basically broken down into a woody compost material for the ground here. Yeah. The unique thing about Sikadak is that they are a community that's expanding and really pushing food security and food sovereignty.
The Coldfire team sourced much of their waste wood from a new greenhouse site that had to be cleared, chipping the material on location. Right beside it sits a thriving community forest, with apple, plum, and cherry trees, and a perfect example of how local waste wood management can support regeneration. The key is having a system in place. When crews clear and chip at the same time, the process runs smoothly. Their long-term goal is to see this mushroom-based wood recycling approach used in logging cut blocks across the region.
Our main concern was around wildfire mitigation and the impact of clear-cut logging on both soil and then what's happening with the waste wood, which is often just getting either left or burned. Either way, it becomes a fire hazard and all the carbon that's being released and the emissions into the atmosphere. And so we want to be able to offer a viable solution to loggers or to forestry to say, hey, chip it. Leave it in the ground. As soon as wood is chipped, even if there's no fungal inoculation, it becomes a way less of a risk for wildfire. So it reduces that wildfire risk almost immediately.
Why?
Because when it's chipped, it holds moisture. As these piles were chipped, if it gets a rain or whatever, it'll hold moisture. These piles will stay moist. Like, you can dig your hand down into them, even in a hot spell. And then they're also helping the soil to recover. In this area, it's pretty healthy soil. It wasn't a clear cut, but when that happens out on the territory or out on the Lac Yip or in the forest, what we're finding is when you go in and you clear cut, you're also exposing a ton of soil to the sun, to the elements, to the rain. So you're really degrading the soil ecology, and this process builds soil ecology. So that's also what we're looking at.
And that's because you want more nitrogen? Like, you were talking about the nitrogen carbon.
Yeah, so this is a way cold fire stores carbon in a stable state in the soil. So what we're looking at is what is the ratio of the carbon to nitrogen ratio that comes from cold fire, mm-hmm. just so that we understand how it could be. Is there the possibility of using the compost at the end of it as a byproduct that could be sold? And then we also just want to know how much carbon is being stored. We do know that none is being released into the atmosphere. So yeah, it's basically we're doing the exact same thing that fire does, but without burning.
And so in this phase here, when you've got the chips, these are chips from healthy trees, but the goal is for treated wood, or we were talking about creosote soaked rail ties and things like that.
Yeah.
So what process do you start introducing those sort of maybe more toxic or wood that would take more work?
Yeah, so that would be, I think, a different process. The nice thing about this is that this is healthy wood, so it can be left in the field. When we're talking about mycomitigation for things like creosote or toxins, you would approach field testing much differently.
Mycomitigation is quite simply the use of fungi to break down pollutants. Here's a video from Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition's Instagram, read by Shantae Mitchell, explaining that process further.
These fungi release enzymes that break down tough plant fibers, speeding up the decay, turning that debris into fire-resistant, nutrient-rich compost. The compost feeds new growth and acts like a sponge, holding moisture, supporting biodiversity, and making forests more resilient to future fires. And instead of slash burning, which can contribute as much as 12% of British Columbia's greenhouse gas emissions, we're choosing a different path. By using cold fire, we sequester that carbon into the ground as nutrients rather than releasing it as emissions. It's about sharing natural, regenerative techniques that anyone can use to care for the land. This isn't about selling a product. It's about working with nature, not against it. And now we're bringing it to our forest with hope, care, and collaboration. We're not here to control the forest. We're here to work with it, to listen, to heal, and protect what protects us.
So it's always do no harm. Any sort of mycomitigation or bioremediation approaches where you're supporting the land to heal itself, the human aspect is do no harm. When it comes to things like creosote or treated wood, you're dealing with some different types of materials. So say, for example, with creosote, where you have that oily kind of polycyclic hydrocarbon sort of stuff in there, you have to be very careful about containing it. So this type of site wouldn't work for that. You would look at doing it in more of a contained vessel. So it's the mycelium that are doing the work for us, and the fruiting bodies are sort of that extra bonus that we see.
Yummy bonuses. I like those.
Yeah.
This bioremediation team's next project takes on something tougher: creosote treated rail ties. Working with bioremediation specialist Lila Darwish, they trained mushrooms in the lab to break down small pieces of the toxic wood. The star performer? Turkey tail mushrooms, known for digesting oils and pollutants. The next step is to grow those lab specimens into full mushroom spawn for field testing.
So that basically those mushrooms, as they get larger and ready to like fruit, they're constantly having more access to creosote as their food source. Mm-hmm. Here in this like field testing with the cold fire, I ate mushrooms off of here last week. Okay. So this is healthy and safe. With creosote, we wouldn't eat those mushrooms, right? Yeah. You're still dealing with toxins a lot of times, so you have to be careful of yourself, of the land, of anything that might come in contact with it, wildlife, birds, whatever, and being really aware that you're not increasing the risk of toxins to get spread, that you're really containing them and dealing with them. So it's not always a perfect solution. We're still, I think in 2026, we'll be able to do a bit more work on the creosote we were very focused on this year. So we're really interested in, figuring out then the best inoculation method for mushrooms and mycelium into a creosote tie.
Along the Upper Skeena, old rail ties have been pushed into nearby ditches, some right above local streams so that when it rains, runoff passes through those creosote-soaked ties and into the water. The team hopes their mushroom remediation work could one day be applied on a large scale, but that's still quite a long ways down the road.
So our role in the Fire Grant Challenge and working on this project here is to see how can they scale up this innovation in a Gitxsan community or in a First Nation community. So there's like a whole piece of that to be like, oh yeah, does this work up here? So a ton of this like project specifically was on just like relationship building and understanding different cultural philosophies and approaches and protocols, data sovereignty and collection processes, and then recognizing that nobody is up here is really an expert mycologist, but we're all expert land people. So leaning into folks who have knowledge in other areas to finish this project has been really helpful.
The Cold Fire team is building partnerships to expand their mushroom-based soil restoration work. Next year, they're planning a project with a Gitxsan whelp interested in applying the method on damaged cut blocks, using fungi to generate soil after cultural or prescribed burns. They're also exploring new techniques like liquid inoculation, which sprays mushroom juice directly onto soil or wood chips, an easier, low-waste alternative to plastic spawn blocks.
So this is actually 3 years in the making, being able to work with Jeff Ravage and the Coalitions and Collaboratives crew, and then the community of Sikidak we've been partnered with for a number of years on a number of different projects, but they were really gracious in giving us the space for the next 3 years. And very interested in the outcome because of their work towards food security and agricultural expansion here. Yeah. They are nearly a food sovereign community with the food sources that they have here. And then any way that we can collaborate and provide education and resources, because it's great to be able to have the connections with partners. And like I said, Smithereens Mushrooms has been awesome. Like, they've just helped us with so many random requests. Mm-hmm. And they're starting to build their mycoremediation branch of their business as well. So the more that we can partner, the better, because we're not experts in the mycology field, as I mentioned. But the more that we can have our local capacity to do some of this work too is also really one of our goals.
The team also hopes to offer mycology and mycoremediation training through the SDOT Farm School's Adult Education Program. By learning to identify, harvest, and cultivate local fungi, participants can help preserve rare mushroom species that support soil health and climate resilience. The goal ultimately is to safely store and grow these beneficial mushrooms for future restoration projects. Thank you so much to Anissa Watson for taking the time to speak with me and show me more about the project called Cold Fire. If you'd like to learn more, visit Skeena Watershed Conservation Coalition on Facebook or on their website. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.
This is Bird Note. We're hearing the calls of royal terns. The birds we call terns look like sporty versions of gulls. Like gulls, most terns are feathered gray and white, but terns are more streamlined, with slender pointed wings and spike-like bills. The black tern carries this sleek look into elegance, cloaking its aerodynamic shape in velvety black. Black terns breed in summer on secluded freshwater wetlands across the northern states and Canada. Here they show off another trait that sets them apart. While most terns make a living by plunge diving for fish, black terns also flutter like swallows over the surface of ponds, snatching insects in midair. Black terns migrate each spring and fall through the American heartland, traveling back and forth to wintering grounds off the coast of Panama in northern South America. But because of major losses of wetlands in their breeding range, especially in Canada's prairie provinces, black tern numbers have dropped dramatically since the 1960s. The future of this beautiful bird depends on protecting and restoring high-quality wetlands. Recent research shows that artificial nest platforms can enhance the tern's breeding success. You can find more about this research on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
Africa Lights by Bobby Hales, and upon which note we end another jazz workshop from the West Coast with Dave Robbins, who has been directing his 10-man group, made up with three saxes, three trumpets, trombone, French horn, piano, bass, and drums. Tonight's workshop was produced in the Vancouver studios of the CBC by Robert Chesterman, and the technical operation was by Bob Gray. Now, this is Ray Nickel reminding you that once again it's back to Toronto at the same time next week, when Phil Nimmons directs his Nine from the CBC Concert Studio. We'll be back here in 2 weeks' time. Good night.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 287, and I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks so much for tuning in. On the program this week, I'm going to be speaking with Cheyenne Karadil, who works with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Cheyenne speaks about a number of important cases that the Center for Constitutional Rights is undertaking. This is a space that has worked very hard to defend people who've been locked up in Guantanamo Bay with no due process in the context of the war on terror, has been a space that has defended Palestinian students detained for their involvement in the Gaza Solidarity Movement, and also has undertaken a number of important cases in relation to legal challenges for the infrastructures of injustice that are being imposed by the current Republican Trump administration in the United States. It was really a pleasure to speak with Cheyenne Karadil of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City for Free City Radio. Here is our exchange. One connection between 2025 and the post 9/11 era to underline is sort of the sort of infrastructural legal links between quote-unquote anti-terrorism provisions after 9/11, and then also how those sort of dynamics are playing out now. There's, of course, the sort of political rhetoric, but then there's also the sort of legal implications. And the Center for Constitutional Rights has